Here, from 1992, the original recording of The Visioneers, a courage story about belief in the future.
Visioneers. Creative Learning International presents Drs. Desmond Berghofer and Geraldine Schwartz telling the story of The Visioneers, a novel by Desmond Berghofer. Geri is a psychologist and educator. She is a scientist practitioner who works daily to enhance human performance. Geri has made a lifetime study of human consciousness and its potential. She is a fun person, a poet, and a gentle guide on journeys and quests for excellence. Geri will be your guide on this tape. With her is the author, Desmond Berghofer, helping to tell the story he crafted over many months with constant support and encouragement from Geri. Des grew up on a farm in Queensland, Australia. He is a man of the earth, a world traveler, and a person who has looked at the future as a discipline to be studied, rather than accepting it entirely as an unknown yet to be experienced. Beyond that, however, he is a storyteller, as you will soon discover. As you listen to his story, he too will be your guide on this tape.
The Visioneers, Episode 1, Gathering Strength.
The Visioneers. Des, do you remember how I first heard this story? You had been writing hard all week. And on Sunday morning, for my reward, I would get to hear what you had written. And so we'd have a good Sunday brunch, bagels and lox, and freshly ground coffee, a big pot so we could have it for the whole read. And you would tell the story. And as I heard, image after image after image floated in front of my mind's eye. And I got so excited by the power of it. And you remember my major complaint? You're not going to stop there, are you? Don't think I don't remember what's happening too. And do you remember the danger that so-and-so is in? You go back and write. And of course, I'd have to wait the next week until you had written the next piece. Well, the reader is not going to have that problem. They're going to be able to turn over the tape and carry on. But I'd like them to know, as they begin, that they will be listening to the story in the old tradition, ancient tradition of our species, of listening to stories the way in olden times people listened around the bonfires, or in an earlier time when, before television and before the kind of electronic media we had, people would tell the stories of Dickens and others, and the audience would listen entranced with image after image floating in front of them. And I'm especially reminded of the piece in Out of Africa. Do you remember, Des? Meryl Streep was the heroine and Robert Redford the hero. And she is an aristocrat from Europe, and she comes to Africa to get married. And with her, she takes the accoutrement of her class, particularly her dishes, her beautiful goblets and cutlery, and she packs them in these wooden crates and carts them across the scorched earth of Africa by train until they come to their final resting place in this remote coffee plantation where she makes her life. And at this particular moment in time, the hero and his friends have been for months in the bush, and they come to visit her, and she prepares this great feast, wonderful food, vintage wine, and as they're gathering around, she tells them that she is a storyteller, and she can begin to tell them a story if they will just give her the intro line. And so they do that, and they sit around entranced as hour after hour the story unfolds in front of them until the wee hours of the morning, and the story continues until its end. So it's in this tradition that we would like the listeners to begin. Get ready for this, for a wonderful story, and listen to the story on many levels. First of all, it's a great piece of entertainment, and it's full of suspense and mystery and romance. And they will hardly be able to let the tape stop. But in addition to that, it has a deep and powerful story statement for our planet and for our times. And people need to listen with their ears so they hear the story, but also with their heart and their mind, and so they let its profound meaning seep into their soul. And so now, Des, would you tell us, what is the story about from the words of the author?
Well, it's interesting to hear you describe it the way you have, Jerry, with a reference to a Sunday brunch and images and all of that, because that's very much the spirit of this piece. You ask me what the story is about. Well, I guess in a nutshell, I would say it's about the idea that people can create the future. And the idea now that's a much more important issue than it ever has been before in the history of the human species. And when I decided to do this, I decided to write it as a story rather than as a descriptive analytical piece, because it seems to me we've got to get into the heart and the spirit of this issue of building a better future for the planet.
Well, in that vein and in that spirit, I'd like to remind the listener that as we listen to anything, we bring our set of beliefs, our view of the world, what we might call our paradigms, to the table. And there is a great danger that we see everything only from that very narrow perspective. But now we need in this story to be enormously expansive and to do what we don't often do in our ready-aim-shoot society, to hold fire. Hey, wait a minute. Open your mind and think and allow the images to come in wave after wave after wave without any judgment. And be part of the story, because this is not a story for a passive listener. This is a story which is a call to action. It's an action call to become a visioneer. So play your part. Take any role that suits you. Listen with your mind, with your ears, with your heart, and with the very spirit of you. Are we ready?
We sure are.
Let's go then.
Okay, well, the way I begin is to use a metaphor, to have a metaphor running throughout the story that is a reference to the future. And I take this out of my own background, which is growing up on the beaches in Queensland, the Gold Coast, near Brisbane, where I grew up. And doing that kind of thing, you get a lot of experience with messing around with waves. And so it seems to me that the wave is a great metaphor for the future. And what we're really concerned with there is three kinds of responses. You know, you can go out there in the waves and have this monster come crashing down on you, and you're completely helpless and you don't know what to do, and you get dumped. The second possibility is you can say, aha, I know how to handle you, and you dive into the wave and try to get out of the way of the turbulence. But of course, that only works for a while, because when you come up, there's another one ready to get you. But the third way is to get on that wave and ride it right into the beach. And it seems to me that what we're trying to do now in terms of dealing with the future is to ride the wave of the future and ride it right into the beach. And I give a description in the book to catch the spirit of that, which I'd like to share now as a way to get started. So here you are, ready to go, riding the wave into the beach. Here she comes. My God, what a beauty. Just arching up into the sky as if she wants to leap right out of the ocean. Go for it. Go now. Strike out. Pull yourself up onto it. A few powerful thrusts and you've got it. Yes, here we go. Oh, what a beauty. Head up in the sunshine, eyes open, the beach rushes towards you. The boiling, surging, thrusting energy of the wave is all around, lifting you, propelling you. Now it's broken, and still you ride it, flattening out, coming in, right in. The sand's under your feet, and you're running, laughing, exultant, right up onto the beach. Arms up, saluting the sun, the sea, the sky, co-creators of the surge of life.
Wow. Now you can take that image, and you can apply it to the future. You can use your mind to ride the wave of the future. And we're in that wave together. The question is, can we use our minds working together to shape the future? If we can, the idea of visioneering is born. And I'd like to read you from the book to get started on that process. We need to become visioneers. Yes, that's it. A new word for a new age. Pioneers of the future. We'll go visioneering, all of us, shaping and riding the waves of the future, doing it in our minds, creating these first, the visions of the possible, teasing them out, building them up until they become so real that they're the life force carrying us forward, living every day on the road towards a future vision, moving that vision as we go so we're always on the journey, riding every wave to moments of celebration, right up to the beach, feet finding the sand in an exultant dance of accomplishment, then back out again, ready to catch the next wave, allowing time to soak up the sunny pleasure of it all. Visioneering, what an idea! What a possibility for the world! What a triumph of mind to be able to explore the future and make it happen! And what better time to begin than right now?
Yes, and the way we do that is to invite the listener to become an active participant in creating the action. And so this whole piece really is a sustained creative visualization in the mind of the listener. And to do this, we create a thinking room. And I'm going to ask you, Jerry, to read the description of this special place. It's a log cabin up in the Rockies.
Well, the sky is blue and puffy white clouds are drifting lazily by. And you're in this special place, tucked high up on a ridge among towering mountains. It's a five-sided log house built out of half-meter thick, fire-killed spruce, each log carefully shaped to fit the curve of the other, cocked and bonded against the piercing bite of the wind and driven snow. Three walls are filled with huge picture windows, opening out onto a breathtaking vista of rocky range, hanging glaciers, towering spruce and pine, alpine meadows, and an aquamarine lake almost filling the valley floor 300 meters below. On one wall, an open fieldstone fireplace crackles merrily, dancing flames licking blackened stonework. Against the other wall, a bookcase containing all the books you have ever read, along with important magazines, newspapers, reports, and journals. Built into the center of the bookcase is a large television screen with powerful stereophonic speakers on either side. This is your thinking place. Sheepskin rugs are scattered on the polished hewn wooden floor. Five solid, comfortable leather chairs stand positioned for warmth and view around the fireplace.
Now, into this thinking room, you invite your mentors, those who are going to be with you from history. And the mentors, three of them, come as great characters from the past. There'll be Winston Churchill, first of all, the great Prime Minister from the time of the Second World War in Britain. And secondly, President John Kennedy, President of the USA during the early 60s, a towering figure of his time and has lived in memory ever since. And then those two are joined by Charles Dickens, the quintessential English novelist from the 19th century. And the three of them together will join you and sit in comfortable chairs that are placed around. And there you are, beginning to think about the challenge that lies ahead. And there's a lot of banter that goes on among these mentors. And then Kennedy picks up the idea of visioning, and he and Churchill run with it. And this is what Kennedy says. You know, this visioneering idea, it's not that different from what we did in the 60s with the Apollo project. We said we'd put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, and by God, we did it. We burned that idea into the minds of everyone who could contribute, and then we let them go at it. And the result was a miracle. We did it then. People can do it again now. Visioneering. Yes, that's a hell of an idea for a new century. What do you think, Winston? And Churchill is on his feet now, his back to the others, feet apart in characteristic defiant stance, staring out at the vista below. Yes, I said as much before you got here. His voice booms out slowly. We need to shore up spirit and courage. Just give people with real blood in their veins and a stubborn pride in their chests some encouragement, and they'll go out and find a way. He turns back to the room. But you've got to get them moving. Put some fire in their bellies, and they'll kick the stuffing out of any petty despot that comes along. Kennedy is laughing. Yeah, I remember, Winston, what you said to those Brits of yours during the war.
We'll fight them on the beaches. We'll fight them on the streets. We'll fight them in the hills. We will never surrender. I always wondered what you'd do if you ran out of countryside. We did, Churchill smiles. That's why I saw to it that America came in to help.
And now a new presence comes into the group, and I'd like to read what I said about her to give you the sense of that. All eyes have turned to meet a new arrival, a bright-eyed young girl of 16 or 17, with an outstanding crop of red hair hanging loose and flowing around her shoulders. Dressed in a high-necked white blouse and long swishing green skirt, she brings a dazzle of color and energy to the room. Hello. She extends her hands and drops little curtsies to the distinguished men in the room. My name is Anne. I call myself Anne of a Thousand Dreams. I'm all the Annes and Alices and Janes that you've ever read about in books. We dream our dreams to make the world a better place. I was never a real person like you gentlemen, so I think my dreams might be just what you need to help you see things differently.
So now we've got all of the mentors in the room with you, and we get into this profound discussion. And Churchill and Kennedy, being the kind of people they are, they tend to dominate things and run with it in grand style. And then finally, after a bit of this, Anne pulls them up once again.
And she says, Mr. Churchill, Mr. Kennedy, I'm not upset by what you said. I mean, I'm not upset at you. You're expressing the issues so grandly and accurately. But it's almost as if there's no alternative to disaster and chaos. That there's no real future at all. Well, I'm sorry. I just don't believe that. No, I'm not sorry at all. I don't believe that. I believe you can have vision and purpose and a grand sense of things you want to do with your life without the need for it to place the whole world in jeopardy. I mean, what's the sense in that? There's no sense in that. And I just don't think people are going to let it happen. Especially the young who've still got most of their dreams left to dream. No, I just don't believe it. What about you, Mr. Dickens? You've got such a wonderful imagination. Can you imagine a world without a future?
If I could, I don't think any of my characters would forgive me for it, replies Dickens. While many of them didn't have very attractive personal futures, they always had hope. Even Sidney Carton, on his way to the guillotine, could see the advantages of his course of action. And Scrooge, of course, when he was shocked into facing bleak future prospects, made a marvelous transformation. Now that's what appeals to me so much about visioneering. It's capital in every aspect.
The discussion continues, and Churchill and Kennedy begin taking the lead. Kennedy sums it up. Would you read that for us, Des?
The world is on the edge of a new adventure. The 20th century has been one of the most savage in human history. Now we're on the threshold of a new millennium of promise, unknown to any previous generation. The seeds of greatness have been sown in the muck and grime of battle on too many fronts. In the barbarous atrocities of too many dark days, in the blind ignorance of what our energies of progress were doing to the planet. But the seeds have been sown nonetheless, and a harvest of riches is at hand for those who can now be good stewards of the land. The time to move is now. Everywhere our project can be the symbol of hope, courage, and determination. With eyes firmly fixed on a positive future vision, people can, frame by frame, weave the fabric of the destiny they desire. That's the message of our project. We're about to begin the journey. Let's show the world what it can mean to be in our company of visioneers.
Bravo, Mr. Kennedy. Bravo, Mr. Churchill. Anne is on her feet, hugging each of the speakers. I'm so excited now. That's exactly the spirit and plan we need. Where do we begin?
Why, at the risk of sounding banal in the presence of such impressive oratory, Charles Dickens is speaking now, I suggest we begin at the beginning. Our host assembled us for this session. We seem to be agreed on a course of action. Our spirits are up for it. Now we're on call for scene one of our exciting drama.
His words bring to a close this session in your thinking room. Suddenly, you're alone. The atmosphere is electric with the energy of your mentors. You close your eyes to rest before the action starts.
But you're not quite ready yet to begin the full action of the story. First of all, you have to go on a journey, a sweep through the earthscape, to get a sense of how things are in the world. And this is something that you must do alone. And you're going to use the magic of your thinking room to make it possible. Listen now for how it happens. Behind you, the dark room suddenly lightens in the electronic glow of the television screen. You turn, and a new world unfolds. On the screen, the baked red earth of an African landscape speeds by, vast, motionless, and empty. Your breath catches at the hard, bright energy of the open savanna, ringed by the dome of an incredibly blue sky. Entranced, you step forward, and in an instant you're swept into the landscape, soaring, full-color cinemascope. You've passed through the screen into this new world, rolling cinematically by and fast forward. It gathers you up, and you're swept along in weightless spirit, a silent, invisible observer of the unfolding panorama.
And now the red earth of Africa speeds by. You see the green savanna, and you come up to the towering ice mass of Kilimanjaro, and the cold pervades you. And then the ocean comes, and you see the whales on the shoreline. You see the waves, and you're sucked up and spun around. And now you're in the ice fields of Antarctica. And suddenly, out of the vast ocean comes the little islands of the Galapagos, and you swoop down, and you see those wonderful animals, turtles, and iguana, and exotic birds, and you're part of it. Oh, I remember being in the Galapagos. It was like time out of time, and you experience that on the earthscape. And then you go across to the South American rainforests, and there you see the first sign of human presence. Before your eyes, you see the destruction of the rainforest, and you realize that the earth is hurting. I'd like to read you a piece to give you a feel of that. Suddenly, you become aware of a deep and spreading pain. At first, it seems to be inside, tugging at your breath, contracting your muscles in searing spasms. But you're not body in this place, you're spirit, weightless, effortless spirit, part of the energy of the cosmos. And the pain you feel is not the physical pain of a distressed body, but rather the spreading agony of a natural system drifting out of balance. All of the wonders you've just visited, superb creations of invisible hand and mind, savanna, mountain, snowfields, ocean, shoreline, ice caves, island jungle, all running with evolved life and energy unique and natural to their time and space. All of this now in jeopardy. And the searing pain you feel is the great grasping of a planetary system responding to sharp and mounting intrusion.
And so your flight now begins again. And this time it's a different vista, because now what you're looking at is the evidence of human activity. And you move to the great industrial machine of North America. Zooming in now, part of the cinematic spectacle captured by a powerful space lens, you arrive on the doorstep of Megalopolis. Monuments, skyline, harbor, ships, airports and planes. Downtown, streets crawling with traffic, buildings of concrete and glass swallowing and disgorging people in perpetual motion. Telephone lines, radio waves, television signals, everything crackles with electrical energy. People are charged with the same intensity, interacting with laughter, rage, exultation, humiliation, triumph, despair, compassion, and cruelty. A short distance away lies the crumbling poverty of the ghetto. Human energy in chaos, searching without finding, strident, demanding, uncertain, and crushed. And now the rest of it unfolds. You sweep across the Atlantic to Europe. And here you find the old, and the new piled on top of the old, crowded. Pollution of the sea and the sky, and argument above argument. And then you sweep on to Asia, and here we find the enigma of China, waiting breathless for the 21st century. and the economic miracle of Japan is here, and then on to Islam, and that country of, and that area of great contradiction, the conflict between Islam and Judaism, ridiculously small in some respects, but enormously large in other. Where there could be symbols of a golden age of progress, a Jerusalem for all ages and all seasons, there's nothing but violent acts of terrorism and reprisal that fuel the basest instincts of the human species. And from there, on to the agony of Africa, the forgotten continent, and then across the Indian Ocean to the complacency of Australia. And from there, going east again across the Pacific, we come to South America and the torment of this great southern continent.
You've seen it all now, the vast and delicate fabric of the natural world and the chaotic interplay of its most intelligent species. Both are locked together, inextricably interwoven in the dance of destiny. Your mind searches for a metaphor, for understanding something to bring order to chaos, some way to fit the pieces of the puzzle together that might give hope for a reality that can endure.
And so you come back to the image of the wave that is going to be rolling forward into the future. And to that you add now the blue dome of the sky as an everlasting piece to hold the earth together. And to the two of those now you add a third symbol. This is the symbol of the silver bridge, which is going to recur over and over in the story. And Jerry, would you read the implication of the silver bridge?
You see a silver bridge arching up into the incredible blue sweep of the sky. You lift yourself up out of the water onto the bridge, where a moving sidewalk takes you along. You turn and look down into the ocean where every eye is turned towards you. You open your arms and beckon them to come and join you on the silver bridge. You see the strain in every face, the black, the brown, the white, every color, every age, men, women, children straining, everyone straining to break free to join you, but no one comes. Something holds them back. Something binds them to the tumult and the turmoil of their present. They don't have the power yet to lift themselves with vision onto the silver bridge, but they're only a breath away, and you know that you must stay and help them find that way, because you cannot ride that silver bridge alone.
So you're back in the waves again. The bridge is still there, gleaming brilliantly in the sunlight, stretching away infinitely into the incredible blue expanse of sky. It's there. The forever symbol of the future that must be imagined before it can be fashioned. Now you turn again to the task of doing that, to the prospect of visioneering, to the searching of every human mind for the possibilities that lie at hand, if we allow the energy of mind to create them.
That's the end of side one on this tape. Could you please fast forward and go on to side two?